Welcome to the Art of Strategic Reaction podcast. I'm Kyle Brost, a strategist and changemaker. I'm the CEO of Spark Policy Institute, founder and principal at Choice Strategy Group, and contributor to Forbes, Thrive Global, and Influencive. I lead at the intersection of strategy and impact, where I turn ordinary individuals into strategists and changemakers. Let's get started. Welcome to the Art of Strategic Reaction podcast. This is Kyle Brost. Today we have Greg Meyerson on with us. He's got a really cool story, life journey in as a striped bass fisherman and appearing on Shark Tank and launching his own business and brand and experiences in how that's been. And so I'm excited to talk to Greg today and hear about that journey and where he's headed next. I know he's got a book that's coming out, so we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about that and some of the other really cool, fun things that he's been doing. Welcome to the podcast, Greg.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So obviously, I just gave a really quick introduction to you. Do you mind to just giving us your Reader's Digest version?
Yeah, well, I'm a lifelong fisherman ever since I was a little kid. I pretty much came out of the womb with a fishing pole. So
is it a family thing? No, your family was a big fisherman?
A lot of the story is in the book that's coming out that I co-authored with Tim Gallagher, called Born to Fish. And a lot of those stories are in there. My family's actually from the city. They're all from Brooklyn. And they moved to the country in Connecticut and built a house and had me. And my brother was already three at the time. But I kind of grew up totally opposite of the whole family. I was in the woods and in the rivers and trapping to make money to buy my first boat that I had at 8 years old, or probably seven or eight.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
so you actually, at that young of an age, you were already kind of out there doing something to earn your own money and get what you wanted.
Yeah. So they're actually planning on making a movie about the whole story, which is pretty cool.
That's so cool.
I never would have ever thought in a million years, like, you know, it just keeps compounding into this crazy stuff that I don't really, look for. It just keeps coming my way. I mean, I'm an electrical inspector. My job, I like what I do. And I still consider fishing, and I want it to be my hobby, And I try to keep it that way. You know, they say, when your hobby becomes a job, you need a new hobby, right? But I don't...
Well, yeah,
I don't want to.
It just reminds me of what they say about mechanics, right? Like if you're a mechanic, your own cars never run because you don't want to do that, outside of it. So it takes some of the glamour away.
Right. Yeah. It's like electricians have the worst electrical work in their houses. Yeah.
So that's actually really cool. So, I mean, at such a young age, you're doing stuff that's different than what your family's doing. You're setting some goals. What inspired you to want a boat, at the age of eight?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. My family belonged to beach clubs, and I fished a lot for trout in the streams behind my house. And I was really into fishing until a friend of mine's father took me striped bass fishing. I think I was six on a sport boat he had. And we caught some big striped bass in the race. And I got really crazy about the striped bass. My family belonged to beach clubs, and I was always around boats. And I kind of drag-netted bait and sold it at the docks for money when I was younger. And always, my life has always been on the water. And a boat was just – something I had to have, and I really started saving for it at a young age and had it in the ocean. I had my own slip. I rode my bicycle there every day. And my parents would tell me not to go past the Branford Town Dock, and that's a harbor in Connecticut. But I was always going as far out as I could at a really young age and got into a lot of trouble on the water with the Coast Guard and without any instruments and the fog and people complaining. And a lot of those stories are in there, but I think the whole twist in this whole story, my father was a bookie for the mob. He was a mobster. So
serious. So
So this whole story isn't really just about fishing, you know. And I just got a great blurb from Robert Kennedy Jr. on the book. He was one of the first people to read it, and he really loves it. He thinks it's going to be a big deal in American fishing literature history. You know, I said, "Wow, that's a great compliment."
Absolutely. Well, so there's I'm assuming, I can't believe, so your dad's in the mob. So you can't tell all the stories about how that boat was used then.
he was in there for a while, and unfortunately he was taken down by the feds.
Oh, man.
I mean, there's a lot of parts of the book that are hard to read, especially for me. The first time I got a reading copy of it and going back and reading it, it was really emotional for me. You know, there's a lot of hard parts in there. I was learning disabled as a kid. My family, my mother was a teacher. My brother went to Yale. My father was a mobster. It was a really weird situation.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. It just sounds great. How old were you when your father got taken by the FBI?
I was a senior in high school. Yeah, just about ready to go to college.
Oh, and really? It's funny.
One of the state cops that was with the FBI on the scene at the time of the arrest had watched me play in the state championship football game at UConn because his neighbor was the head coach of the opposite team. So they knew who I was coming to the house. You know, they knew that I was in there. And there's a lot of funny stories that go along with it. It's not all horrible, you know.
Well, it's interesting is we had a conversation a long time ago about a book I was writing and I had no idea about this aspect That's insane.
You know, my father got really sick and he died from Parkinson's disease really young. And, you know, that took a toll on me as a young kid. And my mother always took as best care as she could of him. And it left me a lot of freedom to go out and do what I wanted. You know, no one was watching what I was doing. So, you know, at a young age, I was on my own, pretty much making my own money, doing various things. It kind of led to my entrepreneurial skills kind of.
Well, I love it. Striped bass is your thing. You mentioned early on that, when you were young, one of your friends' dad, is that what you said, took you out striped bass fishing? I think you fish for all sorts of stuff, but striped bass is your fish.
You know, I'm a bigger trout fisherman,
right?
Fly fisherman, than striped bass.
Really?
I love striped bass,
right?
I always figured ways to try to catch bigger and more fish. And, you know, and I eventually came into the rattlesinker design, kind of by accident. I went to the University of Rhode Island. I was a natural resource major there. That was a kind of a rough time in my life. I had problems with substance abuse and all kinds of other things going on. I started on the varsity football team. I went there on a full football scholarship, all went to crap pretty much because of the condition that I was in at the time, you know? I spent a lot of time fishing at URI. I had scholarships all over the country to different schools. But I went to URI because I could striper fish and it was on the water. I was an all-American football player in high school and all state and all that. So I was a big kid. I had a lot of scholarships I passed them all up to go where I could fish. And, you know, that's all part of the, you know, that's all part of the book too. But there's a lot of crazy stories in there.
Yeah. Well, so, I'm sure I can imagine, and we'll definitely get the listeners to find the book when it's available. So you get it, you have this striped bass experience when you're younger, and tell us about how you, because you hold, well, so first off, what are the records that you hold for striped bass fishing?
I had
or have held
catch and release length record for a while, which fell to Frank Crescitelli, who's a friend of mine, and we fished together. We were in the film, the Striper documentary, Running the Coast, fishing together in a pretty comical scene in there. But I'm going to take that record back from Frank.
I like it.
You know, go ahead.
So at some point you, and I can't remember the whole story, so you'll have to tell us about it, but you did some research about what striped bass like to eat, like the frequencies that they give off or something, and you were able to get some tools and use your electrical background.
This is how that all went down.
Striper
fishing was big in my early 20s and late teens, something I did a lot of, and working as an apprentice in the electrical union in New Haven, our shop was in the worst part of Fairhaven, which is in the middle of the crack epidemic in the late 80s. And our yard where we did all the work, the shop was constant. They used it to smoke crack at night. So there was always vials all over the place. And my boss would be like, all right, pick these, pick these vials up. They're all over the parking lot. And so I had boxes of these vials. And anyway, going out every night and fishing for striped bass, drifting eels in about 90 feet of dark water, I was wondering how these fish could find this eel, in the dark, and they're nearsighted at night, and it was by smell. So I started studying the striped bass more like a science, and realized that they have really terrible eyesight. The way they hunt is sound first, then smell, then they use their eyes for the final attack, which is usually just getting a couple feet in front of their face. So I eventually built a jig at the shop to hold the 16-ounce sinkers we were using to drift in the race, which is a fast body of water where the sound, Long Island Sound, meets the Atlantic Ocean. So you need really heavy weight. So I was like, my friends would all go out on a boat together at night and we would bet on each other, like whoever caught the biggest or the most or whatever got the money, So I'm like, how can I get these fish to my bait instead of theirs? So I thought maybe if I put a little sound in my sinker and they would never see it and know what I was doing, it was the only place I could put a little sound where on the three-way setup that I used drifting eels, that you wouldn't notice it. You couldn't just tie a rattle or something in there, So I, right. So what I did was I put bearings in these vials, but you didn't want them to know where that was coming from. And I started drilling the sinkers on a drill press in the shop, in the electrical shop. And then I would slip the rattle inside, which was really a glass vial with steel bearings, inside the sinkers, and then tamp over the hole with the lead, so it didn't look like anything different than any other sinker anybody else was using on board, The first night I tried it, I think I was 12-1 on everybody else's fish because they were coming to mine and not theirs, So eventually, what started happening was
you're right.
I was starting to get really big fish. And I was using the thing to win money and charter boat pools. I was jumping on all the different charters down in the New London area and entering all the pools. So I'd get the fish for free and I'd win a few $100 a night. And I'd always catch the biggest or the most fish. I was getting banned from one boat to the next. And so eventually I started catching some giant fish, like 60, 70 pound striped bass. And So I wanted to figure, I went into it as a scientist, I dissected some of the biggest ones I've ever caught, and they all had big lobster inside them. I mean, 2-pounders, 3-pound whole lobsters in there. So I was like,
oh, really?
Why am I catching these big fish?
Wow.
I made a tank, I had a 200-gallon fish tank, and I filled it with lobsters, and I use a hydrophone, which is a underwater microphone. And I recorded, okay. I recorded the lobsters, and I would fool around with them, and I would poke them with a hockey okay. stick and piss them off. And they would start this buzzing sound. The microphone would pick it up, and it would show on the graph what the decibel range was. You know, you can get software with a hydrophone, plug it into your computer, or you know. I started to tweak the rattlesnake.
Okay, yeah.
To what I found out was that the striped bass, the biggest ones, were listening for lobster. And lobster, right. when there's a predator around on a reef, make this 10-ish decibel buzzing sound. I'm not going to say what the frequency is. But so what I found out was the stripers are listening for these things. And when there's a – so what I did was – I recorded the rattlesnaker, which was close.
Right.
It was close to the decibel range of the lobster, and it was on the bottom. A lot of rattles in the fishing industry are just rattles, and they make noise. They're just noise. My sound is, you know, wasn't meant to be based on science, but or sounds in nature. But eventually, I tweaked it more and more to get exactly to what those lobster sound. Buzzing sounds were. So, you know, the striped bass goes down there. It's looking around. When the tides slow down, the lobsters come out to feed because they could grab stuff more easily. You know, they have oven mitts. They can't grab food that's flying by them at 6 knots. So when the tide slows down, the food slows down and they can eat more. They feed more. And that's when I threw my, what do you call them? I would make a lot of, digest, you know, I had a digest. I would always find that the big striped bass that I caught were around 1 knot or less of current. And that's when the lobsters came. I started to put it all together. So now I'm figuring out, you know, the moon phases that slow down. The tides are the slowest during first quarter moons. So you have a longer window to fish. And the lobsters feed more during those times. The striped bass feed more during those times. And using my thing just attracted the biggest ones to my bait. And we, you know, when they got to my bait, there wasn't a lobster there, but there was an eel. And, you know, they're not going to pass that up. So that's pretty much, you know, how it worked. And I used it for years to win all kinds of party boat pools and stuff like that. And then I, you know, after that was no longer an option, I went to the Striper Cup, On the Water Magazine Striper Cup, and entered into that. That's like a 10,000 fisherman tournament that goes on from Maine to New Jersey or so every year. And I won that in 2010 with 3 60-pound plus fish. One was 69 pounds.
Holy cow. Wow.
And I won the Angler of the Year. Yeah. And then came back in 2011. And won it again, but also broke the world record
Dang.
For the all tackle with the 82-pounder. And then from then on, it was things were kind of crazy. People wanted to know how, you know, how are you doing, you know, and so I didn't really want to give up my secret weapon, you know.
Oh, I'm sure.
But then, you know, it wasn't the rattlesnaker wasn't made for a business, you know. It wasn't made to be sold,
right.
mass produced. You know, it was made for me, by me, to be used by me. But you know, now with the world record being caught, the opportunity to go to the trade shows and sell whatever I wanted, and they'd pay me to show up and speak, and you know, why not tell everybody what I'm using? You know, I went to UConn Law School. I didn't have any money, and I said. I told them what I had, and they knew who I was. They were fishermen, so they helped me file the patent for it. And after that happened, you know, I still didn't really sell many. I didn't try to mass produce it or anything like that. I sold a few at a few fishing trade shows a year. And Shark Tank, that's when Shark Tank came into the picture. They actually found my patent application. And I got a call one day. I was directing traffic. No, Yes. Yeah.
Oh, really? So you didn't apply to go there. They actually reached out to you. Oh, wow. So actually, I think that there's something really cool about this whole story in that each piece you're building up to this, you know, kind of product and business, but it really is building up to it. It's not like you had this grand vision of the future and where you saw this product being. I mean, literally you're trying to win bets against your friends. You're testing something out. You find that it's, you know, the right frequency and decibel range. You're doing more science or study about, you know, currents and tides and those kind of things. And you're just constantly building onto it. And every time you're building onto it, these new opportunities surface, right? So it starts with, you know, beating your friends and then getting out on these charters and helping other people, you know, and beating the charters and winning money and tournaments. And then you get, you know, even more to these big tournaments, Tackler of the Year, world records. And now you've got Shark Tank.
I was working at the DOT as an electrician at the time.
I was about to tell us how that call came in.
On a lift at an intersection and it was freezing cold. I got a call and I looked and it was from Hollywood, California, you know, and I'm like, I don't really know anybody there. So I answered it. And the lady said, you know, we're from Shark Tank and we found your patent application. What does your product do? I said, oh, it attracts fish. It's a fish call. And she's like, well, really? You know, what's your company? I said, yeah, it's the world record striper company. I named it after a fish I caught. The world record striped bass, and they were like, really, you know. So they said, oh, wow, that's interesting. You know, maybe you'll hear back from us. So I put the phone back in. I was telling my friend, I go, I just got a call from Shark Tank, and he's laughing. He's like, yeah, right, you know. And then that night they called me back, and they wanted to know more. And the more that I told them, the more interested they got. And then it just led to the producers calling me and going over a possible pitch. And then, you know, they flew me out to Hollywood and I got on the show and it turned out to be a real success. You know, it was a hit. The producers were really happy. They thought it was really entertaining, you know, and it was a terrifying experience. I mean, I'm walking into the tank is a hostile environment for sure, you know.
And
I mean,
and you only see. Part
I really
of it,
didn't
right?
have any
I mean,
sales.
Show,
I think I sold 5,000 of them over the course of a couple
You don't have to give me the exact numbers,
years,
but roughly
that,
what were your
at
sales
three or
when
four
that opportunity came?
Different tackle shows in New Jersey at the Somerset show, I sold some, and at the Hartford show, I sold a few. But I never sold them to any tackle shops or anything like that, you know. So I really I'm an electrical inspector and an electrician.
And were you running this business full time, or were you still working? And you kind of had this on the side.
You know, we did it on the side, and still do. You know, this isn't. You know, I'm at work right now. I mean, that's. You know, I always want to. I mean, if somebody else wants to buy this company and take this product, which I've had people ask other companies ask about it and want samples, and I've sent them out I'd be willing to let them take it over and mass produce it because it's a product in the market that, you know, the fishing industry is huge and this product is one of a kind, you know. It's not a version of 20 different things that you see when you walk into Cabela's or whatever. It's the only one of its kind. I own the trademarks and the patents to it, so there's a lot of money to be made if a company wants to take it. You know, me, I don't want to spend all day in my basement making these things and shipping them out. You know, I want to go fishing. No, you know, and kind of the deal with me and Mark Cuban was he was going to handle all that. And Mr. Wonderful was trying to make an offer.
That doesn't sound fun to you.
And Mark Cuban didn't want me to hear the offer. He wanted the product. So I said, all right, you know, I made the deal with Mark. And he had another company that was going to, you know, do the work, but they turned out not to be able to do it for some reason. And I wound up having to do it. And, so I'm kind of, you know, I don't push it. I don't promote it. I don't use any advertising. I don't pay for any advertising. I just use social media and word of mouth that is making it spread, you know? And of course, re-airing on MSNBC Shark Tank for the 20-something time since we've aired in May 1st of 2015 helps.
Nice. You know?
every time.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, so what was, I mean, you talked about that it was a hostile environment. Right. What was that actual experience like? I mean, this came out of nowhere for you with the whole Shark Tank experience. You know, it wasn't even something on your mind.
It's a good people bar room give you a call. Discussion. You know,
so yeah, now you're in Hollywood. What is that experience like?
It was a great experience. You know, I was, here I am, this guy that's been is known as a fisherman, a pretty good one, you know. Some people might say, oh, hey, the guy's actually pretty cool. I didn't want to walk into Shark Tank in front of 10 million people in the country and have them make me look like an idiot. That was my main priority. You know what I mean? I went in there in full defense mode, you know, and along right. with a pitch, you know. And
you're just like, I don't care what happens as long as I don't look dumb coming out.
Hopefully someday they have like a Shark Tank part where they show a lot of the people that went on and the stuff that they edited out, because you know I really got into some sessions with a few of them, you know. It shows about 10 minutes of about an hour you're in there.
Oh really? Well, so how long were you in the, I mean, the episode obviously only shows, I don't know, like 10 minutes total of each person's okay, so you're in there for an hour. So there's all sorts of discussions going on. I'm sure you get into some relatively nitty-gritty details that they don't show on there.
You're staring them down for the first 30 seconds. You know, no, they don't let you say anything. You just have to look at each other, and it's kind of intimidating, you know. But when those doors open up, There's a couple of union workers with hard hats on that open those doors.
Yeah, they're going to capture some good film.
And I was standing there waiting to walk in, and I'm like, "You guys union?" They're like, "Yeah." I go, "I'm a union electrician." You know, they fist pumped me and they're like, "You can do it, man." You know, they pumped me up. They're like, "You can do this. This is your time, brother." You know, and I'm like, "All right." I got all fired up, you know, and I walked in. The days leading up to it, I laid around in a hotel room in Hollywood, you know, with a bleeding ulcer, you know, because I was so worried about it.
Oh, go ahead.
Right.
Oh, geez.
It wound up being $80,000. Well, so 33%
you ended up
company.
Cutting a deal with Mark Cuban, right? And what was the deal that you guys worked out on the show?
Yeah.
And is that still in place? Does he still have 33% of the company? Okay. Have you found that it was, I mean, outside of the exposure of, you know, getting to be in front of millions of people, and like you said, the episodes aired, you know, 20 times now.
Yeah. I mean,
have you found that the partnership with Mark has been, but it, like, you know, it's has been he really, given you other resources and do you guys talk on the phone? I mean, what does that interaction
Mark Cuban
look like?
About business, you know, and his lawyers and business developers and people that I deal with down at Mark Cuban Companies, you know, I have a lot of resources at my fingertips, you know, so the company really wasn't even a company when I walked into Shark Tank, and they kind of helped me brand it, build packaging, a bunch of different things, help build a website, and anything I need them really to do, they'll help me do, you know, and plus, you know, Mark, the way he sets it up is he breaks the companies up into shares, and now you know how many shares you own, and you could sell off some if people want to buy into it, you know. So so this company, you know, and the companies he buys, I think he sets up to be sold later, you know, and then he builds them up so they're worth more than he paid for it, and then he'll probably either unload his parts, his shares, or keep some. Uh-huh. Or hopefully something happens where it could be a huge deal, and you know, so
right.
I'd say probably once a month right now. Yeah.
So how often do you have contact with Mark at this point? Okay. What would something, I mean,
Yeah,
how's
he's a pretty
your,
cool guy. You
what's
know,
he like as a person? I mean, the
he'll send
interactions that you have.
You can tell he's a workaholic.
I mean, he's just somebody that nobody
I'll
else,
get a,
right? I mean, we're
I'll
all
get
looking
a,
at
an
him
email
like
from
this
him at 3 in the
billionaire
morning, and
Mavs
it's like
owner,
maybe
right?
seven words and there's no capitals or periods. He'll be like, straight at it, and want to know. And I'll be like, all right, yeah, I could use a little help with this. And the
Okay.
next day I'll get a call from 10 people,
Right.
Yeah. So,
Right.
so.
Oh, really? Wow. Awesome. I just think that that's so cool. I love the whole storyline of starting just trying to win bets, then finding ways to use kind of science and your tools that you had to make it and improve it, and just constantly building up to the next thing. I just,
Right.
in my business and with my employees, I constantly tell them
Yeah.
to iterate. I'm like, and I said this on the last
Right.
episode that I'm a 50% guy. I'm like, if we think the idea is 50% there, let's do it. And then we'll iterate and work
Yeah,
the rest of it out along the
so
way.
a
And so
buddy
I
of mine that
love
I fish
that
with,
because yours is just an example
Walter
of that.
Anderson, he was a CEO of Parade Magazine for years.
Well, so then
Really smart
when
guy.
did
He was
the book
in
come into
Vietnam,
play? I mean, how did that come
he
about?
fishes the same area that I fish. We're fishing partners a lot. So he's written books. He's a really sharp guy, my mentor, and I'm lucky to have him. And so he was like, I'm going to mention this to some people I know, and tell them, ask them what they think. And then I got a call from a literary agency in Manhattan. Russ Galen called me, and he became my agent, and hired Tim Gallagher, who's a best-selling author and written a bunch of books, to write the book. So that was right around 2012. And then Tim ran into a family. Tim had a family tragedy, after we signed the contract, and it was really horrible what happened. And they wanted to get somebody else to write it. I didn't want anybody else to write it. I'd already met him a few times. I liked
Okay.
him. So he disappeared for a while. A few years went by. He was, dealing with that. And then he came to me strong after that. He was like, I want to do this. Let's do this. And so we started. He slept on my couch. He's a 60-something-year-old professor at Cornell, and he's sleeping on my couch in my little shack that I live in with a dog. And he's sleeping where the dog usually sleeps. So, so this guy, we went through a lot together. He saved my life. And you could read about that in there. Yeah, he did. He saved my life. Yeah. So,
Oh, man.
No,
Like,
I got really
literally
sick,
saved your life?
and while he was there,
Oh, man.
and I would have died that
Well, you
night
got to
if
give
he
me a
didn't
little bit more than that. You
get
can't
me to the
just, I mean, we
hospital.
can save some for the book, but you
And
got to give me a
he
little
didn't
more
even know
than
where
just
we
he
were
saved my
driving
life.
when it happened. And it turns out I had a bad problem going on, he, when I went unconscious, found his way to Yale New Haven Hospital from the middle of nowhere just in time. So, yeah, and a lot of crazy stuff. We've been through a lot of fishing tournaments together, and we just spent a lot of time together writing this book. So then, when it was over,
Wow.
he had a pretty good overview. The book wasn't even written yet. The book, this was just the overview part, so. Then Russ Galen said, "All right, I set up some appointments with publishers. Your first one's with,
Right.
whoever. So we went out and started going to publishing companies, and Houghton Mifflin, which is a huge publishing company in Boston, in the meeting they jumped all over it. They were like, this is great. We want Greg to co-author it with you, and." We want it, and they offered us up a really big, what do you call it, advance, right? They offered a big advance, and I was like, wow, and this is big time. It was starting to hit me that this could be a big deal. And Russ Galen, who is my agent, Advance. Was really happy about it. And he sells all of his books that, or all the books that he has written are made to for him to sell the movie rights. So, you know, the people in Hollywood that he talks to really, you know, really enjoy this story. And I think the movie rights will be sold, whether they make a movie or not. I don't know. I would hope. But the book comes out, you know, it's finished. It comes out in May because my Shark Tank contract goes to May 1st. And once that's expired, I have a lot of opportunities. I had the opportunity to get on a fishing show when Tred Barda, the best and worst of Tred Barda show, when he got paralyzed, they asked me to be the guy to fill in, and I couldn't. I was still stuck in that Shark Tank contract. So I signed a deal to do a show with these producers from that show, a different show, and that's going to start happening this year. Making the pilot episode.
Yeah, interesting.
And you know, the book will be out.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm here right now.
Greg, what's so and through all of this stuff? I mean, launching a company, getting on Shark Tank, writing a book. Now you're talking about movies and TV series. Through all of this, you still work your day job.
Yeah, no, I mean,
I don't know that I've ever had anybody else on the show that's taken
gravy
this far.
That falls into place on its own.
I don't know if anybody's going to believe that you have all of this other stuff and yet you're still showing up, you know, for your day job. I don't know that anybody else would ever say that. I mean, honestly, you're staring at I don't know if you got like shift work or an 8-to-5 or what it is, but you're staring at your day job, and then you've got television series and books, and you're like, that's just gravy. That's just hobby stuff.
Yeah, it's a hobby. It's a hobby that became a business on its own, not by me trying, really.
Right. Well, that's what's so fascinating about this story is literally there's not this grand plan that you're putting all these pieces together. You're just capturing opportunities as they surface and doing with them.
All kinds of different things. Yeah, I just randomly pick one or two here and there, you hit me up a few times, and I was
kind of
like the podcast thing. It's quick and painless, So yeah, I mean, we got into NASCAR too. I mean, that was when Shark Tank aired. You know, we did pretty well, and I sold a little piece of the company to another company and made some money. And I jumped into the NASCAR sponsorship and wound up with the world record striper company car racing against all the big shots down in Dover and Charlotte and Sprint Cup, you know, and I was in the pit crew there. Yeah. We wound up crashing into Jimmy Johnson in our first race and catching on fire. Oh yeah, we were like the low rent team out there. You know, basically we were an advertiser.
You had your own car, really.
I got the whole car, but the car, you know, it's a billboard. That's about it. You know, the owners of the team had me in their trailer down.
Were you there for that? Don't expect to win.
You know, that's my. You know, we're running on practice tires from Jimmy Johnson that he lets us have. You know, so I'm like, well, I want to win. Ricky Bobby. No, actually, Reed Sorensen was the driver. Yeah. So,
So who was the driver? Like cousin Bobby, you know, from.
I'm like the Forrest Gump.
Oh, nice.
I'm like the Forrest Gump.
I just can't. I mean, every time that you tell something new, I'm just baffled by these experiences that you're having. Fish. I mean, now we're talking about NASCARs, and it's just all this,
I didn't really have much of a say. With
that's
the title.
So true.
I mean, Houghton Mifflin, they wanted that. I think it's a good title.
That's got to be. I mean, what's the book called?
I'm sure there's some trademark issues using the Forrest Gump of fishing. You know,
Born to Fish. All right, so it's not the Forrest Gump of fishing.
You can pre-order it now on Amazon, in bookstores all over the country and in Bass Pros and Cabela's and L.L. Bean's and stuff like that.
Yeah, probably. But I like that anyway. And so you say the book comes out in May. It'll be in print. People can actually pick it up in May sometime.
Perfect.
Oh, cool. Well, so I'll find it on Amazon. We'll put a link.
Help the cause.
Release the podcast, we'll put a link directly to pre-order on Amazon. I can't imagine any listeners hearing what you're telling us, all of this stuff, and not wanting to pick up the book. I mean, literally, I'm going to buy like 20 copies.
Well, you know, I turn my seminars into stand-up comedy routines. Because I want
to track what's next. I mean, literally, I'm so baffled by all of these random experiences, how they're all adding up. And it just makes me wonder, like, what the heck is Greg going to be doing in 2 years?
Maybe I'll go into stand-up comedy or something stupid like that. I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe. I don't know. I just...
I think you should. I think you've got tons of fodder for it. So I have one other question that's really been on my mind as we've been talking about this, and it's just because it's such a different life from me. And
we've
been kind of joking, and hopefully this doesn't take the flames out of the hat. But
once a week during the summer,
I just have to ask it before the podcast is up. Did you know?
Yeah, but no, go ahead.
I do want to go fishing. I do. I'm waiting for the invite. All right, I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah, that was kind of hard. It was kind of hard to
the
to
question
hide
that I have,
yeah.
It's totally random. Yeah, we're switching gears here, absolutely. But I just have to ask it before we're done because I'm so curious about it. Did you know that your dad was in the mob?
Oh, yeah.
Like, was that something, I mean, was it just part of the family? Like, you just knew?
Oh, no. It was just something you realized, you know. And I had a lot of uncles that were named Moose and Rocco
from a young age? Or, it was just Joey something you
Fingers
grew up knowing?
And,
or was it something that
guys,
at some stage you were like,
you know, so,
found out, you know? Like, parents sit you down,
older,
like, hey, we've got something to tell you, Greg.
I became a collection man for that business with my father. Most kids have a job like, you know, after school, they, go to the supermarket and bag groceries or something. I was collecting money for the mob. That was part of my job as a high school student until the time where I took about $30,000 from them and took off to our house in Florida for a vacation in my grandmother's car at 16. That was a dangerous situation. That's all in the book. Yeah, pretty much.
Oh my God. I can only imagine. You
Right. My mother wasn't happy about it.
Jeez.
She liked the lifestyle.
Greg, you got like the craziest stories. I can't believe this. Yeah. But so it wasn't, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like a conversation that was had. It wasn't like the family was like, yeah, this is what we do. You just saw it and grew up with it. So you just kind of figured it out over time.
My father paid for his tuition with.
Yeah, always have that conflict.
Yeah, my brother was a great athlete too. You know, he pitched Team USA in the Olympics. He pitched for Yale. Yeah, and then he wound up going to OCS and went into the military as an officer, went right to the Gulf War.
Instead of paying tuition, everybody else and did a bunch of tours, writing a check, and you guys are just walking in with duffel bags.
You know, it was crazy in our house growing up with us two. We were both linebackers and football and baseball players.
Oh, wow.
And we practiced wrestling moves on each other and tore the whole place down all the time. You know, it was pretty wild.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot in there I left out.
Well, that is awesome. I'm excited to catch the book. I've got to get more about these stories that you're telling me. Well, Greg, I can only imagine. I mean, we've only had a few minutes here, and I'm still wondering about all this stuff.
I mean, do what's passionate to you. And
do you have any?
If you really want to,
but do you have any?
Think outside.
Do you have any words of wisdom? Any advice that you would give listeners?
Whatever hobby
you've had these incredible experiences.
There could be a lot of money along the way. If you figure it out, figure something out. You know, I mean, sometimes things happen by luck. You know, and I think a lot of the things that I did were just fell into place by luck, and I made a lot of moves that I didn't know were the right moves at the time, like, you know, filing for trademarks and having a company that I started own the trademarks, which made the company worth more money. I didn't know that. You know, I just said, oh, yeah, just things like that. And try not to ruin your hobby by making it a job. You know, don't take it too serious. Always keep your hobbies your hobbies, you know.
I like it. I like the idea of not keeping it too serious. For me, the big takeaway here is, forget how everybody thinks you should be living
tonight,
your life.
Just do what comes natural and passionate to you.
I mean,
a bunch of products
there are plenty
out
of people that could
and,
be hearing your story.
You know, web
and
orders that I get every
Man,
day.
Man, what an idiot. Why is he still working his job? Why isn't he doing all this other stuff?
A good idea is going to be found out eventually by everyone.
I love that.
You know, spend a lot of time pushing it or not, it just may take longer. And if you own the rights to that idea, then, you know, eventually someone big is going to come along and buy those from you, take it from you. And there's no need to kill yourself over it. Some people do. I'm not too interested in that. You know, I want to be on the water and not in the basement making rattle sinkers, you know?
I like it. Yeah. Well, I love it. I love the sentiment there and just the flow of your story, how you're doing what you want to do and you're doing it your own way. You're not worrying about how other people think it should be done. I love that. The other piece I love is just how you've just constantly built up all of these little pieces.
Yeah,
here
and I have a daughter,
and
I'm
looking
like,
for and you're too, catching opportunities,
you
know, that are really in the periphery, right? They're not things that are right in front of you, but they're stuff that's just surfacing on the periphery, and you're keeping an eye out and capturing those opportunities
already,
while not
11.
Letting go of those kind of daily passions and things that you really want to do.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, absolutely. Is she going to be the next? Is she going to be the next champ? She's going to show you up when it comes to striped bass.
I appreciate it, and I look forward to actually hearing this.
Oh, really? Awesome! That's so cool. Well, hey, Greg, we'll make sure that people can access the book. I love that it's coming out. I'm excited to read it myself. Any last words here before we wrap up? Yeah, for sure. I'll definitely let you know. Thanks so much, Greg, for your time. I'm going to hold you to the offer to go out on a boat with you one of these days. All right. Thanks again, Greg. Have a good one. Bye.